Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Hi, I'm Penny Hancock, author of A Trick of the Mind, which is my third novel.
And could you tell us what A Trick of the Mind is about?
Okay, it's a psychological thriller. It's about a young woman who becomes obsessed with the idea she's responsible for a hit and run that she's heard about on the radio. And so instead of sort of rationalising it out of her mind, she goes to trying to reassure herself by visiting the victim in hospital, who then starts to manipulate her.
Exactly. And there's a couple of drivers that help him, unbeknownst to him, help him manipulate her. Experiences in her childhood.
Part of it is set in Southwold, where her aunt has lived, and she's inherited her aunt's beautiful house by the sea. And she has memories, vague memories about something that happened in her childhood that was sort of dark, that she can't quite remember. So part of the book is her trying to sort of unravel what happened in her past that has left her with this obsessive compulsive nature where she has to keep checking on things, checking she hasn't caused harm to anyone, which is partly why she becomes obsessed at the hit and run.
Yeah, she seems primed for this role.
She seems primed for the role, yeah. And somewhere in her past was a little troubled boy who will turn up again later.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the things that came to me, because and every family goes through this, there's sort of some sort of family secret.
Yeah.
And people try to still keep it secret. And it always comes out. And it's always really, really, really destructive to keep secrets. Like, for me, that was an overriding
It is a bit of a trope in novels, isn't it? Often is there's a family secret
well, and
that
in
comes
life.
Out. But actually, the longer you live, the more you realise that that is often true of your own family.
Mm-hmm.
There often are secrets.
Yeah.
In fact, I've just written an article about the fact that I don't know whether to bring this up now, but my father was very badly agoraphobic when I was a child, but it was never, ever mentioned. So all I understood about the fact that we didn't go out like other families did was that he didn't choose to, and that we were just a family that weren't that sociable. But recently I've discovered how badly he suffered from agoraphobia. It wasn't spoken about. They were ashamed of it. So that was a secret. That was a sort of secret in my family. Not something that is particularly sinister, but it was just something I didn't realize. I couldn't see the whole picture until fairly recently.
How did your mother cope with that?
I think I've realized now that she was very restricted by it, and she kind of not colluded with it, but she was sympathetic to it, but she had to make excuses on his behalf. So often they would refuse invitations to things and she would have to make excuses. Instead of saying, my husband can't cope with social situations, she would sort of say, we're busy, or he's not feeling well tonight, because she was ashamed of it. So it was difficult for her. And I think it definitely restricted her life. They didn't travel, they didn't go out to the theatre, to concerts. So, yeah, but in those days, women were a bit more willing, perhaps, to sacrifice things for their husbands than they would be now.
I was going to say, my husband, we call it antisocial. So I go out sometimes without him.
Yeah, I would go out go out without mine. But I think my mother didn't do much without him, actually. And in fact, they moved to Scotland in the end. They were in London.
That'll keep you in the house.
Well, moving to Scotland.
Yes.
I don't know what Scottish people would say about that. They moved to rural Scotland, so it was fairly isolated. And she gave up a lot moving up there. But he was happier somewhere where there wasn't traffic and there wasn't...
He wasn't constantly confronted.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's something that actually does come up in the book. That's something that you...
I did draw on that a bit because, Ellie's father's agoraphobic in a different way. I mean, the common understanding of agoraphobia is that you don't want to go out at all. My father would go out, but he couldn't go to situations where he felt he couldn't leave when he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But Ellie's father in the book doesn't go out of his flat at all.
Mm.
And so her parents have split up, and her mother's very, very preoccupied with her own relationship and her own life. So Ellie, in a way, she's in her 20s. She's not really got anyone to turn to when things go wrong. Her parents are too preoccupied.
Yeah, which is also, it's kind of scary in that way, because I think And you have been described as somebody who writes about domestic noir. And I think in the way that she, that the protagonist has sort of been primed and is prone to this relationship, is because of this sort of modern world of split up parents who are preoccupied with their own lives. And and she is very isolated.
She's very isolated. So when she gets involved with someone who actually turns out to be, I think I'm not giving too much away to say he's quite a controlling man, she doesn't really have anyone to turn to. She's given up. She begins to give up quite a lot for him, and has no way of turning back, which you can kind of, well, I can imagine it happening. I think I've seen it happening to people I know in a sort of perhaps less dramatic way, but you can see how that can happen.
And so tell me a bit about you, because you have a very busy life, and yet you manage to churn out about you know, a fair amount of writing, along with teaching and
I was teaching when I wrote my first novel, Tideline. I was teaching on a 0.5 contract, which is half the week. But I had sort of afternoons. But at that time, I also had a child at primary school. So, yeah, it's been busy. But actually, I think being busy sort of focuses the mind. So if you want to write, you find time to do it. And that's what I try to do. And things have changed now. My older children have left home, and I'm not teaching anymore. But I do have an elderly mother who's quite demanding and needy. So life's always busy.
There's always something.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Yeah.
Well, and so tell me what that's like. Because your first, you know, so it's the first time you've written Tideline. It's the first time you're being published.
As a novel. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know if you've written.
I was just talking about it to Sam in the taxi, that I've always written, actually. I've always loved writing. So even as a child, I filled up exercise books with stories, sort of adventure stories. And then when I had my first daughter, I went on maternity leave from teaching and started writing freelance articles for the papers about being a mum, that kind of thing. And then I was asked to write I taught English as well, so I was asked to write a course for children who were learning English abroad. So that was kind of quite creative. And that led on to writing some readers for Cambridge University Press for English language students.
Great.
Which were sort of works of original fiction, but with a kind of, it was grade, the language had to be graded, so you had very limited vocabulary.
Interesting.
To write within. But that was good practice for writing a novel.
That's it. Well, because you have to be creative within some strictures.
Yeah.
I used to translate, and so that when you're sort of writing somebody else's words, you know, it sort of makes you itch to do your own.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So in a way that creates a kind of something. The structure itself actually enables you to be more creative in a sense, because you've got to think of, I couldn't use the word, for example, sad or miserable or something. I had to think of a way of putting that without
show, not tell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Get
exactly.
into that, yeah.
Yeah. So it was good practice for writing a novel.
So how did you then make the leap?
Well, it wasn't a leap. It was a sort of gradual process. I mean, I've always wanted to write a novel. So I did write a novel about, it was a kind of coming of age novel that never got anywhere, but it was kind of practice. And then I saw there was an MA in creative writing at my local university. So I applied to do that. And it was actually on that course that I started writing Tideline. And my tutor liked it, and he suggested sending it to his agent. So,
and then it just went kaboom.
And Simon and Schuster took me on very kindly. I was very happy to have them as publishers. So.
Yeah. I mean, and was that sort of life-changing?
That's quite hard to say. I mean, life-changing. It was weird, actually, because I thought it would be more life-changing than it was. But in a sense, it was just a question of shifting career, actually, because I stopped teaching and writing was now my career, and it's work. I treat it as work, so it was like starting a new job rather than having a massive life change that meant that I was somebody different.
Well, and also I suppose once you don't know the success your book is going to have.
No, exactly.
And you've already written it. That's like a year or so ago.
Exactly. Yeah.
By that time.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's validating, but it doesn't affect having, you know, the experience of having written it.
No, exactly. That's true. And also, you know, you're only as good as your last book.
Yes, I'm sure everybody
says that. So you're then worrying about the next one you're going to write.
Puts a lot more pressure on the next
book. And also, because I'd always wanted to do it, I didn't want to lose it. I want to kind of keep writing. But that puts another pressure on you. Mm-hmm. You're kind of suddenly in this position where you don't want to lose the thing that you've always wanted. So, I'm cautious about saying much more than that, really.
Yeah.
But it's a privilege to be able to write as work. For me. I enjoy that.
Yeah. And tell me about the style in which it was written, because I haven't read your other two books, I will confess. But they're very short chapters, and it occurred to me it was almost sort of filmic.
Oh, okay, that's nice.
You know, that it has a quality of scenes.
Right, yeah. I mean,
it's contiguous.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I don't consciously do that, but I think because I'm writing in the first person, it's quite you're seeing things through one person's eyes, so that is quite filmic in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the short chapters, I suppose thrillers lend themselves to short chapters in that you want plenty of cliffhangers, and you know, you need to leave your reader wanting to read on, so doing it in short chapters helps in that way. I think
It's very fast-paced. And I guess it is a really short period of time. I in my experience of reading it, this must have been... it was weeks. You know,
I didn't want to...
It's kind of funny,
to
you sort of tunnel in.
Yeah,
it's really funny.
Again, time's an interesting thing when you're writing, actually, because you do have to be aware of what your time period is. And in Tideline, which I know you haven't read, but it's about a woman who kidnaps a teenage boy and keeps him in her... She's got a beautiful house with a music room at the top, so she thinks she's actually treating him in a sense, but he is sort of unable to leave. But he's actually only there for about 7 days. But because these 7 days last the whole book, it probably feels a lot, in a sense. When I wrote it, it felt a lot longer, and it felt much more sort of a dramatic and long-term kind of abduction than it was.
Well, which is also interesting because, I mean... I think time is a lot more elastic than we
logically absolutely, allow and the elasticity for. Of time. Yeah. And that's something else I want to sort of bring in as one of the themes in what I did in Tideline and in the book I'm writing at the moment. Time is a major thing. I find it so interesting, you know, especially as you get older, how you look back at certain parts of your past that seem very near, very close, and other parts vanish and seem... centuries away.
Yeah, and where one afternoon can seem so long,
exactly,
and yet months during the school year fly by.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
So, string of monotony.
Yeah, so in fact, in this book, A Trick of the Mind, it does take place over a few months. It's months, actually. I think it's from April to August. But a lot happens in that time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those. In her life, it will have been unforgettable time.
Well, also, I think in your 20s, six months can seem like a very long time, very significant. Whereas as you get older, it doesn't seem...
I lived like 2 decades in my 20s and a couple of decades in my 30s and my 40s. Zoop,
exactly.
40s go
very fast.
5 years. Wait a minute. You know, I was doing double time.
That's right. So.
Very interesting themes in your books as well. I was pleased to see that perimenopause played a part in
there
the mother, too.
She's suffering from that very badly.
Yes, exactly.
Some personal experience put in there.
Yes, exactly. I thought that was very funny. No, but as you know, I could relate to both characters.
Well, I could too. Really. Yeah. And I was trying to remember what it felt like to be 20-ish with a with a mother going through that, and you know, they're distracted and preoccupied, and more concerned with their own problems often than yours when you're that age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got 2 daughters in their 20s, and you tend to think once they're in their 20s, they're sort of off your hands and they're all right, and you've sent them off, but of course they've got their issues and they still need you.
When they need you, they need you.
Yeah.
It's not the sort of same constancy as previously.
No, but they have problems, and you know, sometimes I forget that that's still my role as a mother.
You're still expected to drop everything.
Yeah.
You're like, finally, it's me. I get to have my hot flashes in private. You know, no. Well, thank you so much, Penny.
Thank you. It's nice talking to you.
And you.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
end of the bed, it keeps getting clearer. Rings run, running around me. I'm tying the ribbons for the good of the family. And you hear friends gather together. You're looking for trouble, now you're losing your temper.
Cold feet. Useless.
The white dress hangs tall as a tightrope. Clothes pile high in a suitcase. Better get moving, fast forward through. Let out of there. Friends gathered in darkness, formed a search and followed the partners.
Cold feet.
Rings around
the calendar.
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 So phone, phone the red receiver at the end of the bed, but no one will be here.
Cold feet.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production 2014, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.